We're joined by a great friend of the show, Nick James from the Marsden. Nick, the Lancet Commission on Prostate Cancer planning for the future. Planning for a surge in cases. Dozens of authors, 40 pages. It's a marathon, isn't it? It's a marathon. I thought you were long distance cycling and not long distance running.
Yeah. No, I don't run at all, unfortunately, anymore. No. It's been a mission. It certainly has.
What was the point, Nick? What was the point?
Why did you start it? Well, I was invited, which is The Lancet invited me to chair this back in 2019, in fact. And they've been running commissions for a while, and they've previously done very general ones like sort of global surgery or global radiotherapy provision or women's health or whatever. And they decided they wanted to branch out into specific diseases. And they picked, the first cancer they picked was prostate cancer, and they asked me to chair it, which was an honour. And so the brief was to take a 10 to 15 year perspective globally. And I had to sort of just assembling the commissioners was quite a thing in the first place, because we had to have global geographic coverage, range of diversity and all the senses of diversity in terms of specialisms and backgrounds and everything. And they kind of individually vetted each of the commissioners. So it was quite a process getting the agreed list. And so
when you say they vetted, so they had to, people had to sort of qualify to be on the commission.
That's why you and I weren't there, Brian. I'm
afraid. Yeah, right.
For example,
the background checks got us. Yeah.
They wanted a reasonable gender mix. They wanted a good geographic mix. They wanted a good ethnic mix. But also, there was no tokenism. Everybody had to be properly expert in their own right as well.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of that going on. And also they had to be not strongly conflicted by being completely chained to one pharmaceutical company or something.
Got it. So, Nick, let's dive straight into the meat of this. The title suggests that there is a growing problem, and that's not supposed to be a pun. The word you've used is surge. Is that the main theme of this? Because there's actually an enormous amount in it. But what are the main three or four themes?
So the main three or four themes is prostate cancer is already the commonest male cancer in 112 of the 185 countries in the world. It's 15% of all male cancers globally. And although we tend to think of it as a disease of the elderly in sort of Western European or North American countries, it's actually very common everywhere. But very strikingly, we project that the number of cases were 1.4 million last year globally, will more than double to 3 million in the next 15 years. And the reason for that is that it's partly good, to be honest, is that life expectancy is growing, healthcare systems are improving, but also a lot of countries, sub-Saharan Africa, have very young median ages compared to us. So they will simply have more 60-year-olds, partly due to population structure and partly because they're looking after them better. And there's nothing you can do to prevent prostate cancer. It's not like smoking and lung cancer. So they're going to see a very rapid rise in their cases. So the biggest rises are going to be in places like Eastern Asia, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Brazil, and stuff like that. And actually Eastern Europe, surprisingly, as well. And the rise will be mirrored by a rise in deaths, because in all of those places, the majority of men in Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, present metastatic. And so there's an immediate problem around how do you mitigate that harm, but also how do they at the same time deal with doubling of cases in Nigeria, for example, when 60% are metastatic there already. And so a lot of the focus is, well, first, the first part was on the doing the projections, and we're happy those are robust and probably underestimates, to be honest.
And Nick, the projections are quite novel, I'm told. Is that right? These are hot off the press projections. You haven't copied and pasted them from elsewhere. This is sort of new information. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. So one of the commissioners is a chap called Freddie Bray.
You've got some lovely robins in your background, by the way, Nick. I don't know if you're in the garden, but I've got to tell you, we've never been serenaded before by robins in the background.
So it's please quite lovely, don't. Actually.
Yeah. Please keep going, Nick.
It is nice. Yeah. No, I've got, it's a lovely day here. It's a chap called Freddie Bray, who works for IARC and the WHO. He mixed together the population projections, the age structures, and the age corrected rates of disease to come up with these numbers. Now, the biggest hole in the numbers is that registration of stuff is patchy, in a lot of countries. So it's but that just means it's like India, for example, a lot of deaths go completely undiagnosed. So the projections are based on the numbers we know, and there's an unknown number of additional cases that aren't factored into those, which can only make it worse because those.
And you don't, of course, Nick. You can't really take into account changes in diagnostics, let's say, or other ways that men will get diagnosed or not get diagnosed moving forward. So it's kind of based on the current diagnostic skill set, if you will.
It is indeed.
Yeah,
that's correct. Yeah,
Nick. Let's go for a second point then. Let's move on. You talk quite a lot in this around the challenges from a global perspective, particularly because of our public awareness and access to healthcare. Do you want to talk about the summary of that and what you found and what you think we should do?
Yeah, so as we said, in a lot of the world, including in high income countries, to be honest, a lot of men present with advanced disease, and that is partly about opportunity and access, but partly about knowledge as well. And so a key component of improving outcomes is education, both of the public at large, but also medical profession itself. And in terms of the diagnostic pathway, that's where the best way to mitigate A, the current death rate, and B, the likely rise, is to improve the diagnostic pathway. Because if you present with cord compression, outflow obstruction, needing retention and renal damage or whatever, it's a catastrophe and is not good on any measure. If you pick people up before that happens, even if they've already got advanced disease but haven't yet got to catastrophe level, things like hormone therapy will prevent a lot of bad things happening, at least for a few years. So we talk a lot about improving the diagnostic pathway. And because the rate of change is going to be so fast, and against a background where diagnostic pathways are not very good in a lot of places, you kind of need to think about how you might do it differently, which is basically not having consultant urologists, oncologists, radiologists, and so on involved, because you can't train them fast enough and there's not enough of them already.
So Nick, does the commission wade into sort of screening? Obviously that's been debated, as long as we've all been doing this, and it sort of talks about it, but what you're saying is obviously if we screen more patients, we'd find them earlier, et cetera. So does it wade into the PSA screening?
We do. So we've kind of partitioned it into high income countries. And actually the EU changed its policy 2 years ago on screening to essentially recommend that PSA based screening should be set up in member states. And so member states are indeed doing that. But they also recommend that MRI needs to be a key component of it, because otherwise you overdiagnose trivial stuff. Mm-hmm. And that studies need to be done to figure out how best to incorporate those two things, and probably polygenic risk scores as well. And the UK is setting up a big trial looking at that. In low and middle income countries, the thing is completely different. If the problem is that 60% are presenting metastatic, almost certainly the cost benefit utility or whatever of PSA based testing will be much, much higher. Because you're not worried about overdiagnosing Gleason 6 disease. You're worried about underdiagnosing metastatic disease.
Right.
And so we recommend again PSA based pilot projects at scale in low and middle income countries. And we're talking to WHO. I had a meeting with them yesterday and been talking to. It turns out a former classmate of mine is Commissioner of Health for Lagos, which is one of the states in Nigeria with a population of 30 million. And he's very keen to work with us on setting up a pilot PSA testing project as an exemplar. And WHO very keen to support these things as well, because we think that using nurse-based outreach, point of care PSA testing, you can set up diagnostic pathways that are practical for middle-income countries for sure, and potentially mitigate a lot of the damage. And we also make the point that the rise in prostate cancer will be mirrored by a rise in a whole load of other things. So in particular, if at the same time you do an HbA1c for diabetes and measure people's blood pressures, you pick up a lot of other stuff that you can easily mitigate. And just coming back to the Nigeria example, they're setting up a public health insurance system. So we may well tag these projects to getting people to sign up for the public insurance thing, so that you get them insured and then you test them, so that if they have a problem, they're covered for the treatment.
Nick, on the previous point, you kind of suggested that there won't be enough doctors and there not be enough kind of ground resource. And you suggested, if I correct me if I'm wrong, but you suggested you're going to set up systems where you kind of bypass doctors at the beginning part of this journey, but you didn't really explain how you're going to do that.
Yeah, so one of the things we cite is one of my favourite projects of my own, which is the Man Van project, where we went to sort of high deprivation areas of London and ran it as a sort of three-way thing. It was an outreach education thing, which we did through various community groups, nurse-based mobile testing in a van, and onward referral either back to the GPs for diabetes and stuff, and fully 50% of the people had diabetes, hypertension, or some other easily treatable thing that was going to prevent morbidity, or onto specialist care services for raised PSAs and stuff. And we also highlight the fact that the Marsden, all of our biopsies are nurse delivered. We're not doing it through doctors. And transperineal biopsy, nurse delivered, transrectal ultrasound guided is safe, it's teachable, and you can do it without having to train loads of urologists. Yeah, it needs to be medically supervised, but not medically delivered, basically. So we point to that as a practical solution that is relatively affordable. It turns out in Nigeria, for example, they, just sticking with that as an example, they have a very good network of primary care nurse based staff. So the project that we're planning, it will be a nurse based, if it takes off, service.
You talk a lot about your mobile phone as well, Nick. What's going on with mobile phones? So do they have a role to play in all this? I hope not.
Well, yeah. So it turns out that mobile phones are everybody has a mobile phone, and this is just as true in most of the sort of less well-off bits of the world as it is in where you guys live. So over 90% of people in Nigeria have a smartphone. And the technology already exists to have mostly people are very used to getting stuff on apps, and this is true globally. There's no reason why healthcare should be different. And as Tom will know, we've both got the NHS app on our phone that will tell us when we were vaccinated, what drugs we're on, when your next hospital appointment is, all this stuff. And one of the problems, just coming back to the man van that we encountered, was actually one of the biggest problems to solve was what's the medical record system you're going to use? And actually, in the end, we used the Marsden's electronic patient record, which has a patient app. And that was great for tracking the patients, giving them their results, communicating with them, all the rest of it. And you take the responsibility kind of away from hospitals and put it back on the patient if they've got their own records. So we think that actually this is quite a key component for empowering patients. And also, for once you've got things on this sort of technology, you can integrate in things like AI, so that if you know you've got prostate cancer, you can say, well, you should be having hormone therapy for this and facilitate delivery. Which I know it may sound like we're starting from the wrong end of the thing, with electronic patient records on smartphones in middle-income countries. But actually, this is quite often the way around this happens. You might not have a landline, but you probably will never need one, and we're getting rid of ours, of course.
And Nick, you talk about other technology, AI you mentioned, in MRI interpretation, digital pathology interpretation. Like you say, there's not enough boots on the ground of radiologists and pathologists, but they don't need to be in those countries, right? They can be anywhere, or it doesn't have to be a body.
Yeah, so for biopsy, for example, we do think it's important that you confirm disease with a biopsy. And so delivering, coming back to what I was saying earlier, you can deliver biopsies with nurses. Processing it is a technical task. It needs to be sliced, stained, and all the rest of it, and then scanned. Once you've got the digital image, the AI that will interpret path is already very good and will only get better. And I know, right where you are, people might say, well, I want a doctor looking at this, and that's fine. But where you've got no pathologist, the difference between a pathologist and the AI, no pathologist and the AI, and what happens is in African countries, for example, blocks just sit around for months not being looked at and, not necessarily well preserved and all the rest of it. You don't get good results. Whereas once you've got it digitalized, it can be done anywhere and supervised and at scale and stuff. And the same applies to MRI in high-income countries. You know, if you wanted to scale up doing a sort of prostagram, like a mammogram, it's one problem buying the kit and having a quick, simple sequence, which these sorts of things already exist, you know, a 10-minute scan, not the sort of whatever very long things that we're used to with multiparametric. And again, the AI interpretation of those, because they're simpler scans, is already well advanced. So you can still the two in parallel without having to suddenly train lots of radiologists, which is actually the most difficult bit.
So, Nick, you've talked about some of the challenges we face in early disease, and you focused on diagnosis and the surge in lower income countries.
Yeah.
What's going on with early treatment? You've got I think it was a beautiful figure around access to radiation therapy. And some really striking information, because there's no point in diagnosing a whole lot of patients if there's nothing you can do about it.
No, that's correct. So we do emphasize that alongside improving diagnostic pathways, if you successfully do that, you will increase demand, exactly as you say, for surgery and radiotherapy. So these do have to be scaled up. We have a number of African members of the thing, and they're very clear that, you know, you can't just be all gloom and doom. And, you know, there's a growing middle class in Africa. They want the same health. Well, everybody wants the same healthcare that you get in Western countries. But you can realistically deliver, you know, big chunks of it with not necessarily big changes other than just doing more of what we know works. For things like radiotherapy, one of the things we highlight, and there's good examples of this in Uganda, for example, has just set up 4 oncology centers to cover the whole country. So back in the day where we were doing radical radiotherapy in 2 months, yeah, that's clearly a problem if you've got to travel. But we now know you can do hypofractionated radical treatment in a week and a half, probably, possibly even quicker than that. We know you can do it without all singing, all dancing, image guidance, IMRT, Linacs as well, just by backing off slightly on the dose and the scheduling. So if you've only got to go for a week for your treatment, and you can upload the scans, you have the scans anywhere, upload them to the planning system. Planning can be remote to all of this. And then have to go somewhere for delivery, which is a week. That's a much more regionalizable service. And likewise for surgery, of course, you only go for it once. So that can be regionalized. And there's good examples in Brazil, there's good examples in India, there's good examples in Africa of this sort of approach taking off. So we highlight that this is what should be done. You know, hypofractionation for radiotherapy, regionalization of surgery, better diagnostics, using, you know, cheap available technologies and less delivery.
Nick, even with that, I mean, are there enough radiation oncologists and surgeons, right? If the number of cases is going to double or triple, even if it's more convenient, shorter, et cetera, you still need more. The docs there, right? Or no?
No, you do. We do highlight there is a need to train both more radiation oncologists and more surgeons. And this is not just cancer specific thing. I mean, the urologists are very specifically prostate cancer, obviously, but radoncs are a bit more generalist, or can be. And yes, we highlight that you need more of both of those.
Nick, you say all singing, all dancing. Just the good news is the robins have returned. The other bit you talk a lot about is orchidectomy, which is something which, you know, I felt was kind of going out of fashion a little bit. But you talk about the importance of orchidectomy.
Yeah. So if you're newly diagnosed with prostate cancer and your first consultation with the urologist, he says, right, I'm going to castrate you. This is not a popular line to take.
that might be an understatement. Yeah.
So what happens is, of course, everywhere in the world, people get put on injectables. Now, and they cost a lot, and a lot of people in a lot of places in the world are self-funding these things. That applies in America, it applies in Africa, it applies all over the place. And they're not inconsiderable cost. So again, we did a piece of work with the Brazilian healthcare system where we got access to the numbers, the costs and all the rest of it, and just submitted it as a paper. But essentially, you pay $65 a month, roughly, for Zoladex in Brazil. You pay $85 as a one-off cost for orchidectomy. So, yeah, average length of time on treatment in Brazil is 36 months. You can do the maths. It's much cheaper to have the orchidectomy. Now, the thing that men are worried about is things like sexual function and so on. But once you've been on Zoladex for a while, you'll realize that actually it's gone anyway. and anywhere your testicles atrophy on it. So at that point, saying, well, would you like to switch to a subcapsular orchidectomy and save yourself all this money? That's a different discussion to the upfront discussion. And then the second thing is that there are things like low-dose abiraterone. So 250 mg abiraterone is taken with food is as good as full-dose abiraterone. So it then means you've got an income stream that instead of spending the dollars on the Zoladex, you spend it on the low-dose abiraterone, and then you live longer. So whoever's paying for it, either the healthcare system or the patient, you can deliver longer survival with that sort of approach than you can deliver with paying for the Zoladex and not having the abiraterone. So we feel there's a sort of there's a nuanced way of approaching this that actually people will, once they've been established on treatment, will see is a, maybe a better way.
And that, Nick, just requires, if you will, a culture shift among both providers and patients, right?
It does,
to,
yeah.
to accept it, right? To accept that sort of undesirable surgery, if you will, that it, and at the outset seems awful, but then as you get through it, as you explain, it's kind of the same, right? It's really the same. I guess the pushback would be, you know, there are discussions around de-escalation of therapy and can we stop hormones in certain settings, et cetera. Obviously, if you have an ORC, you can't do that. I realize that's just a subset of patients, but that would be the downside, of course.
Yeah. Of course, yeah. No, if you're planning to limit the therapy, then obviously that's not a good approach. But the other thing actually you can do, which actually we didn't put in there, but it was pointed out to me afterwards, and with hindsight, it's a shame we didn't have it in the report, is that these things are massively overspecified products. So a 3-month Zoladex implant will actually last 6 to 9 months. So actually what you do is in 3 months' time, you don't give them the Zoladex, you measure their testosterone, which is considerably cheaper. And you only give them the next injection when it starts to go up. And after a few 3-month injections in older men, the PSA never, the testosterone never recovers. So you then just repeatedly measure their testosterone rather than injecting them with expensive drugs. And so there are other ways of, again, mitigate, as you say, de-escalation, of a different sort that mitigates the costs and allows you to divert the expenditure somewhere else, either personal expenditure or the health system.
Nick, Brian and I were in the Ghana. You probably didn't see us, but we were there. We met Vedang and various other people from around the world. I know that Fernando was there from Brazil, all of whom were on the paper. Yeah. And there was a session in Lugano around this issue. Yes. I was really intrigued by the Indian approach, which talks about this sort of hybrid efficient approach where you get 90% of what you want, but at 10% of the cost.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain what that's about and why that's so attractive?
Yeah. I mean, well, as you put it, that is kind of it in a nutshell. I mean, just to give you one specific example, high-income country radiotherapy centers spend a fortune on immobilization devices, and these are sort of complex, CE-marked, all sorts of this, that, and the other, and very expensive. And one of the things they'd set up at Tata Memorial was they'd set up their own 3D printing thing. So they make immobilization devices for radiotherapy in-house at a fraction of the cost that we pay. I mean, another example was surgical robots. Both India and China had examples of this where they've developed their own surgical robots. So they're not the ones that are operating at the Marsden. They're probably just as good or nearly as good, but they're much cheaper. So, and obviously India and China are rather weird mixes of the very poor and the incredibly wealthy. So they have the ability to do this. But once these devices exist, of course, they can be distributed elsewhere.
Do you think we've got to a stage where in parts of healthcare, in some parts of the world, we are pursuing caution to such a degree that it's become really cost inefficient?
We do. And so one of the things we emphasize is around research. And so we overdo measuring, you know, adverse events in trials and this sort of thing. So particularly if you're doing a drug repurposing trial. So very topically, we're just about to report the metformin results from Stampede. So this is a drug repurposing where we're, you know, the hypothesis is that either that we mitigate the side effects of the ADT or rather more hopefully that we improve the survival, and data will be presented at ESMO. But yeah, you end up collecting shed loads of AE data on a drug that is used by literally millions of people every day. So the chances we find some weird side effect are essentially zero. So we've wasted, as far as I'm concerned, hundreds of thousands of pounds tracking, because we have to, side effects and all the rest of it. And because the regulations require us to do it. And I think one of the things we say is we need to deregulate trials where you're de-escalating or comparing treatments that are well established, because the safety issues are simply not the same as they are if you're testing first in man of some novel chemical entity, where obviously they have to be super stringent. And
I felt this was a bit of a home game for me when I read this, and I thought, you know, I don't actually totally agree with you, Nick. I think it's quite a grey area.
Okay.
And I think that from a global perspective, there is an inherent anxiety around clinical trials.
Yes.
And I think that you, me and Brian are really bought into them. But I think there are other people who are sceptical about what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by reducing the quality of the data we collect, we lend ourselves to perhaps more debate about, you know, did it really not add any additional toxicity?
Think it's reducing the quality of the data. I think Nick's point is when we're studying a drug that's 10 years old that we know well, we shouldn't burden ourselves by trying to find new things, or, you know what I mean?
No, in broad terms, I agree with that. But I think when we do trials, if inevitably we don't collect all the information robustly, we may come unstuck.
I think that's a fair point. I think
I had to disagree about something. Nick, I just had to. I apologize. I always disagree about something. I thought I had to on
this. No. So just to give you a concrete example where of this. So we Stampede, the control therapy was androgen deprivation therapy. And for most of the time we were running the trial, we just said, just have standard of care through your GP. And then we introduced estrogen patches into the trial as an alternative way of doing ADT. And that had the effect of making all of the control arm therapy ADT a CTIMP.
Right.
And it then turned out, and we didn't know this, and we probably should have done, that the data sheets, for example, for Zoladex and Luprolide differ because they, at the point they were registered, they registered whatever side effect. So, like, for example, on one atrial fibrillation, there's a side effect, and on the other, it's not. Then we had an MHRA inspection and they said, well, you've got atrial fibrillation on Zoladex or whatever, whichever way around it was. That's a SUSAR. And then they said, you must have hundreds of unreported SUSARs. Oh, and of course we did. But they're not really SUSARs because it's very well known that cardiovascular side effects occur on all of these drugs. It's just a class effect, but it's not on the data sheet. So they literally tied the trials units at UCL in knots for 2 years while we tracked down these, you know, SUSARs that were never SUSARs. Complete waste of time, money, and effort. And we did a resensitivity analysis with and without the SUSARs, with and without all of this stuff. Of course, had no effect on the effectiveness of abiraterone, which was the other CTIMP in those bits of the trial. And just a colossal waste of
time. Inevitably, if one has to invest a huge amount of resource in what are relatively inexpensive therapies, the tens or hundreds of millions of pounds required to do these trials means that they become cost ineffective, which means that's why cancer drugs are so expensive.
Exactly.
I think we would agree there needs to be an element of common sense that sometimes there isn't, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's sort of what we're talking about.
Essentially,
I think maybe we could, we haven't talked too much about advanced disease and CRPC. Yes. Maybe we could end there in terms of what the commission recommended.
So in essence, I'd be spending a lot of time looking at sort of abiraterone versus enzalutamide or whatever, or PARP inhibitors and stuff. And we do talk about this stuff, but actually the most striking thing is that the best way to improve outcomes is to do what we know works already. And you get the most benefit from the first line of therapy. So what we found was that in most high-income countries, USA and UK, both the same here, around 30 to 40% of men get what you might call intensified androgen deprivation therapy. And probably a lot of the 70 or so percent who don't get it would benefit from it. Obviously, there's a subset of men who are so old and frail or whatever that they shouldn't get it, but I think that's the minority. So just simply delivering what we know works is the shortest cut to improving outcome with metastatic disease. And that applies in all income settings, in fact. We highlight ways of potentially making some of these therapies more affordable by adjusting the ADT. And actually, the other thing we've got coming out from Stampede, what we're talking about just in the ADT, is estrogen patches will report this year at ESMO as well as a non-inferiority. And estrogen patches, you don't lose bone density and all sorts of things. It's less harmful cardiovascular-wise than ADT. So there are potentially other ways of doing stuff. And we think that's the most important thing, is just to do what we already know works. I mean, there is, of course, a need for new drugs and all the rest of it. But that wasn't really where we focused.
It was not. There was a long piece on mortality, and there were some beautiful mortality graphs. What has that mortality data taught us, Nick?
Well, I think so one of the things, one of the points I was making in APCCC the other week is that if we want to improve outcome for men with advanced prostate cancer, actually fiddling, are debating whether we, you know, switch Abby to Enza in the second line in CRPC or whatever is kind of a sideshow compared to just diagnosing people earlier, treating them better, and treating, you know, ensuring people get the right treatments. Because most of the deaths are not occurring, are not going to occur in the places where we work in the future. And so that the lesson from the mortality is that if you really want to impact advanced prostate cancer, we have to be, you know, persuading other people to do things better.
Nick, I read in awe at the scope of this document. It must have been a huge amount of planning and changes, and I can't imagine how one can even start with these sorts of projects. I also didn't recognise that you had new data in there.
Yeah,
you know, some of that data is actually new. So I've got to tell you, I thought it was fabulous.
Thank you so much. That's really, very much appreciated. Yeah, and it has been a huge amount of work. It's been a big chunk of my life.
Congrats to you and everybody on the commission. It's great work.
Thank you.
Looking forward to seeing you soon, Nick.
Yeah, and you both.
Thanks for joining.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye. Bye-bye.